miserable. We may actually be doing them harm. As for the leaders of companies who think that it's okay to save a number before saving a person, consider the chain of events that ensues as a result. There is only one way we can solve this problem: by building and maintaining circles of safety where we work. Pointing fingers is not the solution. Pulling together and doing something is. And the good news is, there are powerful forces that can help us. If we can learn to harness these seemingly supernatural forces, we can put right what is so wrong. This is no soapbox rambling. It is just biology. Part 2. Powerful Forces. Chapter 5. When Enough Was Enough. To say it was a rough neighborhood is an understatement. It was about the worst place anyone would want to live. It was incredibly dangerous. There was no such thing as heating in the winter, and there certainly wasn't any air conditioning in the summer. There were no supermarkets of any sort. The residents were left to forage or hunt for any food they could find. Survival under these conditions was something people really had to think about. Every moment of every day, there could always be something out there that could do them harm. Worrying about an education or getting a job wasn't even on the radar. There were no classrooms. There were no hospitals. As things stood, there were no jobs to be had. None. And for good reason. There were no companies. There weren't even any countries yet. That stuff was so far off in the future, they didn't need to think about it. This is not some post-apocalyptic Mad Max scenario. The time is 50,000 years ago, and modern man, Homo sapiens, is taking his first steps out in the world. This is where we come from. Our ancestors were born dirt poor. Opportunities didn't come their way because of the schools they went to or who their parents knew. Any opportunities came from their will and hard work to create them. And create them they did. Our species was built to manage in conditions of great danger and insufficient resources. Life in Paleolithic times was not like the aftermath of a hurricane. That's not scarcity, that's destruction. Our ancestors were not the stereotypical caveman we like to imagine. They didn't have oversized brows or walk around hunched over carrying a club. They looked like we do today and were just as smart and capable as we are today. The only things they didn't have yet were all the advancements and advantages of our modern world. Other than that, they were just like you and me. Nearly everything about humans is designed to help us survive and perpetuate the species through tough times. Very tough times. Our physiology and our need to cooperate both exist with our survival in mind. We are at our best when we face danger together. Unfortunately, there are too many leaders of companies who believe, in the face of external challenges, that the best way to motivate their people is by creating a sense of internal urgency or pressure. Based on our biology and anthropology, however, nothing could be further from the truth. When we feel like we belong to the group and trust the people with whom we work, we naturally cooperate to face outside challenges and threats. When we do not have a sense of belonging, however, then we are forced to invest time and energy to protect ourselves from each other. And in so doing, we inadvertently make ourselves more vulnerable to the outside threats and challenges. Plus, with our attention facing inward, we will also miss outside opportunities. When we feel safe among the people with whom we work, the more likely we are to survive and thrive. That's just the way it is. In the beginning. There's something about Homo sapiens that makes us much better adapted to survive and prosper in the austere conditions into which we were born, even better than some of the other hominid species that were bigger and stronger than we were. Part of our advantage is thanks to the neocortex, our complex, problem-solving brain. It also gives us the ability for sophisticated communication. Unlike other animals able to communicate, we're capable of syntax and grammar. But another critical reason we survived was thanks to our remarkable ability to cooperate. We are a highly social species whose survival and ability to prosper depend on the help of others. Our ability to work together, to help and protect each other, works so well, in fact, that our populations did more than survive. They thrived. Elephants survived also, but the life of an elephant today is largely the same as it was millions of years ago. But not us. Our lives are completely different than they were 50,000 years ago. Though our species was molded to suit our environment, we were so good at working together and solving problems that we found ways to mold our environments to suit us. The better we did, the better we got at changing our conditions to suit our needs instead of being changed to suit the conditions. The problem is, our basic genetic coding remains the same. We are an old-fashioned bunch, living in a modern, resource-rich world. This has its obvious advantages, but, like everything, comes at a cost. It's all about the group. Living in communities that maxed out at about 150 people, we knew everyone and trusted that the people in our group understood it was in their own interest to help the group. The men went out and hunted together, and the whole community worked together to raise the young, care for the sick and the elderly, and look out for each other. There was conflict, of course, just as there is conflict in any group, but when push came to shove, they put all their differences aside and worked together. Just as we may have serious issues with one of our siblings, if someone else threatens them, we will rise up to defend them. We always protect our own. Not to do so goes against what it means to be human, and ultimately does damage to the group's ability to survive and thrive. This is one of the reasons that treason is punishable in the same way as murder. Given its importance to our ability to survive, we humans take this trust thing really seriously. Our success proves it. Cooperation and mutual aid work better than competition and rugged individualism. Why add another degree of difficulty by fighting against each other when we were already forced to struggle against the hardships of nature, limited resources, or other outside threats? This cooperative village life existed from the Amazonian rainforests to the open plains of Africa. In other words, it was not the physical environment that determined our best chance for survival and success. It was the very biology of our species, the design of the human being itself. The manner in which we evolved, to help each other, worked regardless of where we came from or the unique hardships we may have encountered. Every single human on the planet, regardless of culture, is naturally inclined to cooperate. As we'd expect, it wasn't all hard work. We're social animals, and being social was as important to us thousands of years ago as it is today. It was a significant way we built and maintained trust, and the way we got to know each other. The time we spend getting to know people when we're not working is part of what it takes to form bonds of trust. It's the exact same reason why eating together and doing things as a family really matters. Equally as important are conferences, company picnics, and the time we spend around the water cooler. The more familiar we are with each other, the stronger our bonds. Social interaction is also important for the leaders of an organization. Roaming the halls of the office and engaging with people beyond meetings really matters. Perhaps the closest example of a modern system that mimics our ancestral kinship societies is the college dorm. Though students may have their own rooms, which are usually shared, doors are often left open as students socialize between the rooms. The hallway becomes the center of social life, and rooms are for homework and sleeping. And sometimes not even that. The bonds of friendship that form in those dorms are vital. That's where college students tend to develop their closest friendships, not in the classrooms. Our success as a species was not luck. It was earned. We worked hard to get to where we are today, and we did it together. We're built to work together. We are, at a deeply ingrained and biological level, social machines. And when we work hard to help each other, our bodies reward us for our effort so that we will continue to do it. Our chemical dependency. Thanks to the trial and error of evolution, almost every detail of our physiology is there for a reason. Mother Nature did not provide us with the highly tuned taste buds simply so that we could enjoy a fine glass of wine from the Staglin family vineyard, or savor every bite of a pork bun from Momofuku Sambar. Our taste buds tell our digestive systems which enzymes to release to best deal with the food that's on its way down, just like our sense of smell helps us detect if food is spoiled or not. Similarly, our eyebrows were designed to help channel sweat away from our eyes when we're running toward prey or running away to avoid becoming prey. Everything about our bodies was designed with one goal, to help us survive. This includes the feeling of happiness. Just as any parent, teacher, or manager knows, if they offer the promise of bounty, like candy, gold stars, or performance bonuses, or the threat of punishment, they can get the behavior they want. They know we will focus our attention on the tasks that produce the results that earn us rewards. Kids aren't aware that their behavior is being conditioned, but as adults, we're completely aware of what our companies are doing when they offer us incentives. We know that we only earn our bonuses when we get the results they want. And for the most part, it works. It works really well, in fact. Mother Nature figured out a lot earlier than our bosses, however, to use an incentive system to condition us to do certain things to achieve desired results. In the case of our biology, our bodies employ a system of positive and negative feelings, happiness, pride, joy, or anxiety, for example, to promote behaviors that will enhance our ability to get things done and cooperate. Whereas our bosses might reward us with an end-of-year bonus, our bodies reward us for working to keep ourselves and those around us alive and looked after with chemicals that make us feel good. And now, after thousands of years, we are all completely and utterly chemical dependent. There are four primary chemicals in our body that contribute to all the positive feelings that I will generically call happy: endorphins, dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin. Whether acting alone or in concert, in small doses or large, any time we feel any sense of happiness or joy, odds are it is because one or more of these chemicals is coursing through our veins. They do not exist simply to make us feel good. They each serve a very real and practical purpose: our survival. The paradox of being human. Human beings exist as individuals and as members of groups at all times. I am one, and I am one of many. Always. This also creates some inherent conflicts of interest. When we make decisions, we must weigh the benefits to us personally against the benefits to our tribe or collective. Quite often, what's good for one is not necessarily good for the other. Working exclusively to advance ourselves may hurt the group, while working exclusively to advance the group may come at a cost to us as individuals. This tension often weighs on our consciences when we make decisions. I appreciate the irony that we even debate, as individuals and as groups, which one is primary. Some believe we should always put others first, that if we don't look out for the group won't look out for us. Others believe that we should always put ourselves first, and that if we don't take care of ourselves first, then we would be of no use to anyone else. The fact is, both are true. Even in our own biology, there exists this seeming conflict of interest. Of the four primary chemical incentives in our bodies, two evolve primarily to help us find food and get things done, while the other two are there to help us socialize and cooperate. The first two chemicals, endorphins and dopamine, work to get us where we need to go as individuals, to persevere, find food, build shelters, invent tools, drive forward and get things done. I like to call these the selfish chemicals. The other two, serotonin and oxytocin, are there to incentivize us to work together and develop feelings of trust and loyalty. I like to call these the selfless chemicals. They work to help strengthen our social bonds so that we are more likely to work together and to cooperate, so that we can ultimately survive and ensure our progeny will live on beyond us. Chapter 6, EDSO. Without selfish chemicals, we would starve to death. It's common knowledge that we shouldn't go to the supermarket when we're hungry. We always end up buying too much and buying things we don't really need. We buy too much because everything we see we want to eat now. Because we're hungry, that's obvious. But the more interesting question is, why do we go to the supermarket when we're not hungry? Our ancestors of the Paleolithic era lived in times when resources were either scarce or hard to come by. Imagine if every time we felt hungry, we had to go hunting for a few hours, with no guarantee we'd catch anything. Odds are our species would not have survived very well with a system like that. And so our bodies, in an effort to get us to repeat behaviors that are in our best interest, came up with a way to encourage us to go hunting and gathering on a regular basis instead of waiting until we were starving. Two chemicals, endorphins and dopamine, are the reason that we're driven to hunt, gather, and achieve. They make us feel good when we find something we're looking for, build something we need, or accomplish our goals. These are the chemicals of progress. E is for endorphins, the runner's high. Endorphins serve one purpose and one purpose only: to mask physical pain. That's it. Think of endorphins as our own personal opiate. Often released in response to stress or fear, they mask physical pain with pleasure. The experience of a runner's high, the feeling of euphoria many athletes experience during or after a hard workout, is in fact the endorphin chemical surging through their veins. This is one of the reasons runners and other endurance athletes continue to push their bodies harder and harder. It's not simply because they have the discipline to do so. They do it because it actually feels good. They love and sometimes crave the amazing high they can achieve from a hard workout. The biological reason for endorphins, however, has nothing to do with exercise. It has to do with survival. The caveman application of the chemical feel-good is far more practical. Because of endorphins, humans have a remarkable capacity for physical endurance. Save for all the marathoners out there, most of us can't imagine running for miles and miles on a regular basis. But that's exactly what gave our ancestors an edge while hunting during the Paleolithic era. They were able to track an animal over great distances and then still have the stamina to make it home again. If the trusty hunters gave up at any time simply because they were exhausted, then they and those in their tribe would not eat very often and would eventually die off. And so Mother Nature designed a clever incentive to encourage us to keep going, a little endorphin rush. We can actually develop a craving for endorphins. That's why people who are in the habit of regular exercise sometimes crave going for a run or getting to the gym to help them relax, especially after a stressful day at work. Our ancestors probably wanted to go hunting and gathering, not simply because they knew they had to, but because it often felt good to go. Again, the human body wants us to feel good when we go looking for food or when we're doing the hard work of building shelter so that we will more likely do it. Thanks to cars and supermarkets, however, we live in a world with readily available and abundant resources. The body no longer rewards the search for food, at least not with endorphins. In this day and age, we basically get our endorphin hits from exercise or manual labor, with at least one notable exception. Stephen Colbert, political satirist and host of the Colbert Report, commented during an interview on the importance of laughter in tense times. "You can't laugh and be afraid at the same time," he said, and he'd be right. Laughing actually releases endorphins. They are released to mask the pain we're causing to ourselves as our organs are being convulsed. We like laughing for the same reason runners like running. It feels good. But we've all had the experience of laughing so much, we want it to stop because it starts to hurt. Like the runner, the hurt actually began earlier. But thanks to the endorphins, we didn't feel it until later. It is the high we get, which continues after the laughing has ceased, that makes it hard to be, as Colbert says, afraid at the same time. During tense times, a little lightheartedness may go a long way to help relax those around us and reduce tensions so that we can focus on getting our jobs done. As President Ronald Reagan famously joked with the chief surgeon on March 30, 1981, as he was wheeled into the operating room at George Washington University Hospital after being shot by John Hinckley Jr., "I hope you're all Republicans." To which the surgeon, a self-described liberal Democrat, replied, "We're all Republicans today, Mr. President." D is for dopamine, an incentive for progress. Dopamine is the reason for the good feeling we get when we find something we're looking for or do something that needs to get done. It is responsible for the feeling of satisfaction after we've finished an important task, completed a project, reached a goal, or even reached one of the markers on our way to a bigger goal. We all know how good it feels to cross something off our to-do list. That feeling of progress or accomplishment is primarily because of dopamine. Long before agriculture or supermarkets, humans spent a good portion of their time in search of the next meal. If we couldn't stay focused on completing basic tasks like hunting and gathering, we wouldn't last very long. So Mother Nature designed a clever way to help us stay focused on the task at hand. One way we get dopamine is from eating, which is one of the reasons we enjoy it. And so we try to repeat the behaviors that get us food. It is dopamine that makes us a goal-oriented species with a bias for progress. When we're given a task to complete, a metric to reach, as long as we can see it, or clearly imagine it in our mind's eye, we will get a little burst of dopamine to get us on our way. Back in the Paleolithic era, if someone saw a tree filled with fruit, for example, dopamine was released to incentivize them to stay focused on the task and go get the food. As they made progress towards that fruit tree, they would see it getting slightly bigger, an indication they were getting closer. And with each sign of progress, they would get another little hit of dopamine to keep them on their way, and another, until they got a big hit when they finally reached their goal. Eureka! It's the same for us. As we get closer to our goals, the metrics tell us we're making progress, and we get another little hit to keep us going. Then finally, when we reach our goal, that intense feeling of got it is a big hit of dopamine, our biological reward for all that hard work. Each milestone we pass is a metric, a way to see that the fruit tree is getting closer and closer. Like a marathon runner who passes each mile marker toward the finish line, our bodies reward us with dopamine so that we will keep going, working even harder to reach the huge pot of dopamine, the intense feeling of accomplishment at the end. Obviously, the bigger the goal, the more effort it requires, the more dopamine we get. This is why it feels really good to work hard to accomplish something difficult, while doing something quick and easy may only give us a little hit, if anything at all. In other words, it feels good to put in a lot of effort to accomplish something. There is no biological incentive to do nothing. Our goals must be tangible. We are very visually oriented animals. We seem to trust our eyes more than any of our other senses. When we hear a bump in the night, we want to see that nothing is there before we can relax and go back to bed. When someone we're getting to know makes a promise or claims they have accomplished something, we want to see it to believe it. This is the reason we're so often told to write down our goals. If you don't write down your goals, so the saying goes, you won't accomplish them. There is some truth to this. Like seeing that fruit-filled tree in the distance, if we're able to physically see what we're setting out to accomplish, or clearly imagine it, then we are indeed, thanks to the powers of dopamine, more likely to accomplish that goal. This is the reason we like to be given a clear goal to achieve to receive a bonus instead of being given some amorphous instructions. It's not very motivating or helpful to be told that we will receive a performance bonus if we achieve more. How much more? Give us something specific to set our sights on, something we can measure our progress toward, and we're more likely to achieve it. This is why people who balance their checkbooks or maintain a budget are more likely to save or not overspend. Saving is not a state of mind, it's a goal to be achieved. It is also the reason why a corporate vision statement must be something we can see in our mind's eye. That's why it's called a vision, because we need to be able to see it. Like the amorphous instructions, having a vision of, quote-unquote, being the most respected company in our category is useless. Respected by whom? The customers? The shareholders? The employees? The CEO's parents? If we are unable to adequately measure progress towards that vision, then how will we know if we're making worthwhile progress? Visions of being the biggest or the best, or any other words that so often show up in vision statements are, on a biological level, pretty useless if we want to inspire people to work hard to achieve those visions. A good vision statement, in contrast, explains in specific terms what the world would look like if everything we did was wildly successful. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. told us that he had a dream, that one day little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. We can imagine that. We can see what that looks like. And if we find that vision inspiring and worthy of our time and energy, then we can more easily plan the steps we need to take to achieve that vision. Short or long term, the clearer we can see what we're setting out to achieve, the more likely we are to achieve it. It's exciting thanks to dopamine. This is why the best visions offer us something that, for all practical purposes, we will never actually reach, but for which we would gladly die trying. Each point in our journey is an opportunity to feel like we're making progress towards something bigger than ourselves. When the system works as designed, we stay well fed, get our work done, and make progress. What's more, we're better able to support and provide for those in our family and tribe. Dopamine can help us get through college, become a doctor, or work tirelessly to realize an imagined vision of the future. But there's some fine print at the bottom of the bottle that is often missed. Dopamine is also highly, highly addictive. As helpful as it is, we can also form neural connections that do not help us survive. In fact, they may do the complete opposite. The behaviors we reinforce can actually do us harm. Cocaine, nicotine, alcohol, and gambling all release dopamine, and the feeling can be intoxicating. The chemical effects notwithstanding, the addictions we have to these things and lots of other things that feel good are all basically dopamine addictions. The only variation is the behavior that is reinforced that gives us the next hit of dopamine. There's another thing to add to the list of things that can hijack our dopamine reward system. Social media. texting, email, the number of likes we collect, the ding, the buzz, or the flash of our phones that tell us you've got mail feels amazing. As it should. We have associated the dopamine-releasing feeling of, ooh, something for me, with getting a text or email or the like. Yes, it's true. We hate all that email, but we live for that ding, the buzz, or the flash that tells us something's there. Some of us have formed neural connections that drive us to carry our phones in our hands at all times, often looking down and hitting refresh a few times, even though nothing has come in. Gimme dopamine. It is said that if you wake up in the morning and the first thing you crave is a drink, you might be an alcoholic. If you wake up in the morning and the first thing you do is check your phone to read your email or scan through your social media before you even get out of bed, you might be an addict. Craving a hit of chemical feel-good, we repeat the behaviors that we know can produce that hit. In the case of alcohol or gambling, we're aware of it. In the case of our love of our devices and social media, we are less aware of the addictive qualities. In a performance-driven organization in which dopamine is the primary means of reward, hit the goal, get the money, like gambling, we can become addicted to making the numbers. The only question is, are our modern addictions innocent, or are there unintended side effects that are causing us harm? But I will save that discussion for later. It is because of dopamine that in our modern day, we like shopping or collecting things. Though there is no rational benefit to most of our hobbies, we enjoy them because they satisfy our prehistoric foraging desires. If we get addicted and can't stop, like any dopamine addiction, as good as it may feel, it often comes at a high cost. We spend more time and money than is wise, and sometimes sacrifice our relationships just so we can get another hit. Accomplishment may be fueled by dopamine, but that feeling of fulfillment, those lasting feelings of happiness and loyalty, all require engagement with others. Though we may not reminisce about that goal we hit a decade ago, we will talk about the friends we made as we struggled to make it. The good news is, we also have chemical incentives that reward us with positive feelings when we act in ways that would earn us the trust, love, and loyalty of others. All we have to do to get those feelings is give a little, which is pretty handy because, as we all know, we can get a lot more done together working with people we trust than we can alone. Endorphins and dopamine work together to ensure our survival as it relates to food and shelter. They help us get things done so that we will be housed and fed. It's not an accident that we say that we need our jobs to survive. We really do feel that way. Without endorphins to give us the edge we need to keep going, we would not keep striving even when we were tired and exhausted. Dopamine rewards us with a chemical rush when we've accomplished something, making us want to do it again and again and again, which is exactly what it takes to find things, build things, and get things done. But it's harder to do all these things alone, especially the big things. Together is better. The selfless chemicals. Finding, building, and achieving are only part of our story. It is the manner in which we make progress that is core to our ability to do well in a dangerous world. It is the selfless chemicals that make us feel valued when we are in the company of those we trust, give us the feeling of belonging, and inspire us to want to work for the good of the group. It is the selfless chemicals that keep the circle of safety strong. Without social chemicals, we'd be cold-blooded. A carcass of a wildebeest floats down a tributary of the Zambezi River in Botswana. The soon-to-be meal passes two hungry crocodiles that both call this part of the river home. Seeing the food, they both lunge at it, but only one will win. The faster, stronger one of the two will be the one to eat that day. Acting completely out of instinct, it will consume the carcass and swim away with a full stomach and absolutely no care in the world about the other crocodile. And though the other crocodile may swim away hungry, it will harbor no ill will toward its adversary. There is no part of the crocodile's reptilian brain that rewards any cooperative behavior. The animals have no positive feelings when cooperation is offered, and thus no incentive to cooperate. They are, by design, cold-hearted loners. That's just how they were designed to work. Nothing personal, all instinct. And for a crocodile, it works. We, however, are not like crocodiles. Though we may share the primitive reptilian portion of our brain with them, our brain continued to grow beyond its reptile roots. We are anything but loners. The addition of the mammalian layer of our brain helped us to become highly functioning social animals. And for good reason. If we weren't adapted to live in tribes and cooperate, we would have died off ages ago. We don't have thick, scaly skin to make us less vulnerable to attack. We don't have rows of sharp teeth like a great white shark, able to keep chomping even after we lose a few. We're just not strong enough to survive alone, let alone thrive. Whether we like to admit it or not, we need each other. That's where serotonin and oxytocin come in. They're the backbone of the circle of safety. There to encourage pro-social behavior, serotonin and oxytocin help us form bonds of trust and friendship so that we will look out for each other. It is because of these two chemicals that we have societies and cultures, and it is because of these chemicals that we pull together to accomplish much bigger things than if we were to face the world alone. When we cooperate or look out for others, serotonin and oxytocin reward us with the feelings of security, fulfillment, belonging, trust, and camaraderie. When firing at the right times for the right reasons, they can help turn any one of us into an inspiring leader, a loyal follower, a close friend, a trusted partner, a believer, a Johnny Bravo. And when that happens, when we find ourselves inside a circle of safety, stress declines, fulfillment rises, our want to serve others increases, and our willingness to trust others to watch our backs skyrockets. When these social incentives are inhibited, however, we become more selfish and more aggressive. Leadership falters, cooperation declines, stress increases, as do paranoia and mistrust. If we work in environments that make it harder to earn these incentives, then our desire to help our colleagues or the organization diminishes. And absent the presence of commitment, any desire our colleagues may have to help us also declines. A vicious cycle is set in motion. The less our colleagues and leaders look out for us, the less we look out for them. The less we look out for them, the more selfish they become, and as a result, the more selfish we become. And when that happens, eventually everyone loses. Oxytocin and serotonin grease the social machine. And when they are missing, friction results. When the leaders of an organization create a culture that inhibits the release of these chemicals, it is tantamount to sabotage. Sabotage of our careers and our happiness, and sabotage of the success of the organization itself. The strength of the culture, and not its size or resources, determines an organization's ability to adapt to the times, overcome adversity, and pioneer new innovations. When the conditions are right, when a strong circle of safety is present and felt by all, we do what we do best. We act in the manner for which we were designed. We pull together. S is for serotonin, the leadership chemical. I haven't had an orthodox career, and I've wanted more than anything to have your respect, said Sally Field as she stood on the stage, gripping the Oscar she'd just won for her role in the film Places in the Heart. The year was 1985. The first time I didn't feel it, she admitted, but this time I feel it, and I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me. What Sally Field was feeling was the chemical serotonin seeping through her veins. Serotonin is the feeling of pride. It is the feeling we get when we perceive that others like or respect us. It makes us feel strong and confident, like we can take on anything. And more than confidence boosting, it raises our status. The respect Sally Field received from the community significantly impacted her career. An Oscar winner is able to make more money to appear in a film, will have more opportunities to pick and choose the films they would prefer to work on, and will command greater clout. As social animals, we more than want the approval of those in our tribe. We need it. It really matters. We all want to feel valuable for the effort we put forth for the good of others in the group or the group itself. If we could get that feeling alone, then we wouldn't have award ceremonies or company recognition programs or graduation ceremonies. And there certainly would be no need for any counters to display all the likes we get on Facebook, how many views we get on YouTube, or how many followers we have on Twitter. We want to feel that we and the work we do are valued by others, especially those in our group. It is because of serotonin that a college graduate feels a sense of pride and feels their confidence and status rise as they walk across the stage to receive their diploma. Technically, all a student needs to graduate is to pay their bills, fulfill their requirements, and collect enough credits. But graduation probably wouldn't feel the same if we received only an email with a generic letter of congratulations and a downloadable attachment of the diploma. And here's the best part. At the moment the college graduate feels the serotonin course through their veins as they receive their diploma, their parents, sitting in the audience, also get bursts of serotonin and feel equally as proud. And that's the point. Serotonin is attempting to reinforce the bond between parent and child, teacher and student, coach and player, boss and employee, leader and follower. That's why when someone receives an award, the first people they thank are their parents, or their coach, or their boss, or God, whoever they felt offered them the support and protection they needed to accomplish what they accomplished. And when others offer us that protection and support, because of serotonin, we feel a sense of accountability to them. Remember, these chemicals control our feelings. That's why we can actually feel the weight of responsibility when others commit time and energy to support us. We want them to feel that the sacrifices they made for us were worth it. We don't want to let them down. We want to make them proud. And if we're the ones giving the support, we feel an equal sense of responsibility. We want to do right by them so that they can accomplish all they set out to do. It is because of serotonin that we can't feel a sense of accountability to numbers. We can only feel accountable to people. This helps explain why it feels different to cross a finish line alone, without spectators, compared to when a crowd cheers us as we break the tape. In both cases, the accomplishment is the same, the time is the same, even the effort is the same. The only difference is that in one case, there are others there to witness and cheer for us. I felt this when I ran the New York City Marathon a few years ago. One of the things that kept me going was knowing that my friends and family had come out to support me. They spent their valuable time and energy to brave the traffic and crowds, simply to get a quick glimpse of me as I ran past. We even planned when and where I would be, because it made them proud to see me out there doing something hard. And it inspired me to keep pushing myself, simply knowing that they were there. I wasn't just running for me anymore. I wasn't just running for the rush of endorphins and dopamine. Because of serotonin, I was now running for them too. And it helped. If all I wanted to accomplish was to run 26.2 miles, if all I wanted was the dopamine thrill of accomplishment, I could train and do that on any given weekend. But I didn't. I ran on the day my family came out to support me, the day the organizers offered me a crowd to cheer me on. Better still, I got to wear a medal, a symbol of the accomplishment, which made me feel proud when I wore it around my neck. Serotonin feels good. The more we give of ourselves to see others succeed, the greater our value to the group, and the more respect they offer us. The more respect and recognition we receive, the higher our status in the group, and the more incentive we have to continue to give to the group. At least that's how it's supposed to work. Whether we are a boss, coach, or parent, serotonin is working to encourage us to serve those for whom we are directly responsible. And if we are the employee, player, or the one being looked after, the serotonin encourages us to work hard to make them proud. Those who work hardest to help others succeed will be seen by the group as the leader or the alpha of the group. And being the alpha, the strong, supportive one of the group, the one willing to sacrifice time and energy so that others may gain, is a prerequisite for leadership. O is for oxytocin, chemical love. Oxytocin is most people's favorite chemical. It is the feeling of friendship, love, or deep trust. It is the feeling we get when we're in the company of our closest friends or trusted colleagues. It is the feeling we get when we do something nice for someone or someone does something nice for us. It is responsible for all the warm and fuzzies. This is the feeling we get when we all hold hands and sing Kumbaya together. But oxytocin is not just there to make us feel good. It is vital to our survival instincts. Without oxytocin, we wouldn't want to perform acts of generosity. Without oxytocin, there would be no empathy. Without oxytocin, we wouldn't be able to develop strong bonds of trust and friendship. And without that, we wouldn't have anyone we could rely on to watch our backs. Without oxytocin, We would have no partner to raise our children. In fact, we wouldn't even love our children. It is because of oxytocin that we trust others to help us build our businesses, do difficult things, or help us out when we're in a bind. It is because of oxytocin that we feel human connections and like being in the company of people we like. Oxytocin makes us social. As a species that can accomplish more in groups than as individuals, we need to have the instinct to know whom to trust. In a group, no one person has to maintain a constant state of vigilance to make sure they are safe. If we are among people we trust, who trust us, that responsibility can now be shared among the entire group. In other words, we can fall asleep at night, confident that someone else will watch for danger. Oxytocin is the chemical that helps direct how vulnerable we can afford to make ourselves. It is a social compass that determines when it's safe to open up and trust and when we should hold back. Unlike dopamine, which is about instant gratification, oxytocin is long-lasting. The more time we spend with someone, the more we are willing to make ourselves vulnerable around them. As we learn to trust them and earn their trust in return, the more oxytocin flows. In time, as if by magic, we will realize that we have developed a deep bond with this person. The madness and excitement and spontaneity of the dopamine hit is replaced by a more relaxed, more stable, more long-term oxytocin-driven relationship. A vastly more valuable state if we have to rely on someone to help us do things and protect us when we're weak. My favorite definition of love is giving someone the power to destroy us and trusting they won't use it. It's the same in any new relationship. When we first show up to a new job, we're excited. They're excited. Everything is perfect. But the trust we need to feel that our colleagues would watch our backs and help us grow, to really feel like we belong, takes time and energy. Personally or professionally, all the same rules of relationship building apply. As much as we want to stand out and consider ourselves individuals, at our core, we are herd animals that are biologically designed to find comfort when we feel like we belong to a group. Our brains are wired to release oxytocin when in the presence of our tribe, and cortisol, the chemical that produces the feeling of anxiety, when we feel vulnerable and alone. For our prehistoric ancestors, as well as all social mammals, our sense of belonging and confidence that we can face the dangers around us literally depend on feeling safe in our group. Being on the periphery is dangerous. The loner on the edge of the group is far more susceptible to predators than the one who's safely surrounded and valued by others. Someone who feels like a bit of a social misfit because of an unusually high love of Star Wars or superheroes finds great camaraderie when attending Comic-Con or some other fan convention. To be around others like us makes us feel like we belong and gives us a sense of safety. We feel accepted as part of the group and no longer suffer the anxiety of feeling like we're on the edges. There are few feelings that human beings crave more than a sense of belonging, the feeling of being inside a circle of safety. Generosity and other ways to build trust. I was walking down the street with a friend of mine when the backpack of a man walking in front of us opened up, spilling papers onto the sidewalk. Without a thought, we bent down and helped him gather up his papers, and I pointed out to him that his bag was open. That tiny favor, that little expense of time and energy, with no expectation of anything in return, gave me a small shot of oxytocin. It feels good to help people. The man we helped also got a small shot of oxytocin, because it feels good when someone does something nice for us too. We stood up and continued walking. When my friend and I reached the end of the block, we stood and waited for the light to change so we could cross the street. As we stood there, another man standing in front of us turned around and said, "I saw what you did back there. That was really cool." And that's the best thing about oxytocin. Not only does the person performing even the tiniest act of courtesy get a shot of oxytocin, not only does the person on the receiving end of the act also get a shot, but someone who witnesses the act of generosity also gets some chemical feel-good. Simply seeing or hearing about acts of human generosity actually inspires us to want to do the same. I can almost promise you that that guy who turned around to us to tell us he had seen what we had done very likely did something nice for someone that day. This is one of the reasons we find movies or in news stories of incredible selfless acts so inspiring. This is the power of oxytocin. It actually makes us good people. The more good things we do, the more good we want to do. This is the science behind paying it forward. Oxytocin is also released with physical contact. That warm feeling we get when we hug someone we like for a few seconds longer, that's oxytocin. It is also the reason it feels nice to hold hands with someone, and the reason young children seem to always want to touch and hug their mothers. In fact, there's lots of evidence that children who are deprived of human contact, deprived of sufficient doses of oxytocin, have trouble building trusting relationships later in life. It is also part of the reinforcing bond between athletes, for example. When they high-five, fist bump, or smack each other, it reinforces the bond they share and the commitment they have to work together for their common goal. Suppose you're about to seal a deal with someone. They have agreed to all the terms laid out in the contract. Just before you sign the contract, you stick your arm out to shake your soon-to-be partner's hand. "No, no," they say. "I don't need to shake your hand. I agree to all the terms laid out, and I'm excited to do business with you." "Great," you reply. "So let's shake on it." "We don't need to," they say again. "I agree to everything and am ready to sign and start doing business." Rationally speaking, you just got everything you wanted in the contract. But their simple refusal to make physical contact, to shake your hand, to reinforce the social bond with a little chemical trust, means one of two things will happen. You'll either call the whole deal off, or you'll go into the deal a little more nervous. That's the power of oxytocin. That's the reason it's a big deal when world leaders shake hands. It's a sign to each other and to all who witness that they can do business together. If our president were ever seen shaking hands at a UN event with some horrible dictator, it would cause a massive scandal. A simple handshake. But it's not just a simple handshake. Physical contact demonstrates a sign of our willingness to trust, even more than the terms of the deal. Oxytocin really is magical stuff. Not only is it behind the feelings of trust and loyalty, it also makes us feel good and inspires us to do nice things for others. Mother Nature wants the ones who give to others to keep their genes in the gene pool. That may be one of the reasons oxytocin actually helps us live longer. A person who is good to others in the group is good for the species. According to a study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2011, people who claim to be happy live 35% longer than less happy people. The study of 3,800 men and women, aged 52 to 79, found that those who rated their happiness the highest were far less likely to die in the following 5 years than those who were the least happy, even after accounting for demographic factors such as wealth, occupation, and health-related behavior such as smoking and obesity. Oxytocin boosts our immune systems, makes us better problem solvers, and makes us more resistant to the addictive qualities of dopamine. Unlike dopamine, which is largely responsible for instant gratification, oxytocin gives us lasting feelings of calm and safety. We don't need to check in to see how many likes or followers we have on Facebook to feel good. Because of oxytocin, just knowing our friends and family are there, just looking at a picture of the people whom we love and who love us, make us feel good and not feel alone. And when that happens, we want more than anything else to do what we can to help them feel the same way. Chapter 7. The Big C. It was warm and sunny out, a day just like one would expect for the time of year. There was a calm, gentle breeze that broke the intensity of the sun. It was, by all accounts, a perfect day. All of a sudden, out of the corner of an eye, the calm was shattered. Perhaps it was the rustle of the grass, or maybe he thought he saw something. He couldn't be sure, but frankly, it didn't matter. All that mattered was that there might have been something out there, something dangerous, something deadly. The anxiety alone was quite enough for the gazelle to stop grazing and immediately lift its head to try to see what it hoped was not a lion. Another gazelle noticed that one of the members of its group was alerted to a possible threat, and it too immediately stopped eating and looked up. Two sets of eyes are better than one. Before too long, the whole group had joined in. None of them knew specifically what they were looking for. They only knew that if one of the members of the group felt threatened, they should all feel threatened. Then, in an instant, one of the gazelles, one that wasn't originally alerted to the potential threat, saw the lion about to pounce and instinctively made a mad dash in the opposite direction. Whether they also saw the lion or not, all the gazelles in the herd followed in the same direction, all running at full speed. The lion attempted to give chase, but couldn't run for long before it ran out of energy. The surprise attack was foiled, and all the gazelles got to live another day. This is one of the primary benefits of group living. Every member of the group can help look out for danger. If one individual in the group senses danger, the whole group can help spot it before it's too late. It is a familiar scene played out in many a nature documentary. Sometimes the lion makes the kill, and sometimes it doesn't. But the response from the gazelles is always the same. First, one or a few of them sense something is amiss. Then they try to get a bead on the threat, and if there is a threat, they run for their lives. It is that initial feeling, that sense that something might be out there that would do them harm, that sets the whole scene in motion, and at the end of the day gives the herd a greater opportunity for survival. That feeling that something is wrong is a natural early warning system all social mammals have, including us. It is designed to alert us to threats and heighten our senses to prepare us for possible danger. Absent that feeling, we would only be alerted to danger when we actually saw something or when the attack had already begun. And from a survival standpoint, that probably would be too late. Those 22 Special Operations Forces in Afghanistan that Johnny Bravo risked his life to protect are a perfect example. They could feel something wasn't right that night. That gut feeling that they, the gazelle, and the rest of us get that something dangerous is lurking is caused by a chemical called cortisol. Cortisol is responsible for the stress and anxiety we experience when something goes bump in the night. It is the first level of our fight or flight response. Like a high-security alarm system that automatically calls the police, cortisol is designed to alert us to possible danger and prepare us to take extra measures to protect ourselves to raise our chances of survival. Apply the same scene of the gazelles to an office scenario. One person hears a rumor that there are going to be layoffs. He tells a friend at work, and before too long, just like the herd of gazelle, one by one, the word spreads and the whole office starts chatting and worrying, anxious about the impending layoffs. All the employees have a heightened sense of alertness thanks to the cortisol flowing through their veins. The stress they feel will distract them from getting anything else done until they feel that the threat has passed. In the event of an actual threat, like police responding to an alarm, adrenaline is released into our bloodstream, giving us energy to get away or boost our strength to face our foe. If you've ever heard stories of mothers who suddenly gain superhuman strength to save their children, that comes from adrenaline. But if there is no threat, we take a deep breath, wait for the cortisol to leave our bloodstream, allow our heart rate to return to normal, and relax again. Cortisol is not supposed to stay in our systems. It is supposed to fire off when we sense a threat and then leave when the threat has passed. And for good reason. The stress on our bodies is serious. The manner in which it reconfigures our internal systems can cause lasting damage if we have to live in a perpetual state of fear or anxiety. We all know what cortisol feels like when we fear for our well-being. But it is also behind the feelings of anxiety, discomfort, or stress we have at work. Unlike gazelles, humans have sophisticated neocortices, the part of our brain responsible for language, as well as rational, analytical, and abstract thought. Whereas a gazelle reacts to the cortisol in their bodies, we as humans want to know the cause of our stress, to understand or make sense of our feelings. We often try to find the source of what we think is threatening us, real or perceived, to explain our unease. We may blame a boss who lies to us. We may blame a colleague who we fear would stab us in the back to advance their own career. We may beat ourselves up for speaking out of turn at a meeting. We cycle through any number of things we did or did not do to help us understand why we feel anxious. The paranoia cortisol creates is just doing its job. It is trying to get us to find the threat and prepare for it. Fight, run, or hide. Whether the danger is real or imagined, the stress we feel is real. Unlike our rational minds, our bodies do not try to assess what the danger is. We simply react to the chemicals flowing through our bloodstreams to prepare us for what might be lurking. Our Paleolithic brain doesn't care about understanding the threat. It just wants us to increase our chance of survival. What's more, our bodies don't understand that we work in offices and not in open savannas. Our ancient early warning system doesn't understand that the danger we face is hardly life-threatening, which is why, in an effort to help protect our interests, that system prompts us to react as if it were. A friend of mine who works at Columbia University went to an office to fill out some administrative paperwork. He was polite and friendly to the young woman sitting at the desk, but she wasn't polite or friendly back. Though she didn't say anything rude or wrong, he could sense that she wasn't that concerned about him or his needs. She answered his questions with a word or two, and didn't give him any extra help or directions beyond what was minimally required, even when he asked. When he engaged with the next person, again, he felt like he had somehow bothered or upset him simply by asking him to do what was his job. Although, as employees of the same organization, it was in their mutual interest to assist him, the clerical staff seemed ambivalent about, even resistant to cooperating. In an office like the one my friend stepped into, people would prefer to keep to themselves, engage only when necessary, do their work, and go home at the end of the day. There is no sense that anyone would risk themselves or go out of their way to offer protection to another. And because of this, though there is no threat of layoffs and the work stress is low, there is a constant low-grade anxiety. As social animals, we feel stress when we feel unsupported. That subconscious unease, the feeling that we are responsible for ourselves and no one else is there to help, the feeling we get that most of the people with whom we work care primarily about themselves, is, to our primitive brain, quite scary. And the problem is not with the people, it's with the environment. When a gazelle senses trouble, it alerts the rest of its herd, increasing the chances of survival of all. Unfortunately, many of us work in environments where members of the group don't care much about one another's fate. Which means that valuable information, like impending danger, is often kept secret. As a result, bonds of trust among employees or between leaders and workers are weak, if they exist at all. We are all left almost without an option but to put ourselves first. If we fear our boss doesn't like us, if we are constantly worried that if we make a mistake, we will get in trouble, if we think that someone we work with will try to take credit for something we did or stab us in the back to get ahead, if we pay attention to too much media hype, if we fear the company isn't going to make its numbers this year and layoffs may be around the corner, if people are generally disengaged, if we do not feel the circle of safety, cortisol starts to seep through our veins. Drip, drip, drip. This is a serious problem. For one thing, cortisol actually inhibits the release of oxytocin, the chemical responsible for empathy. This means that when there is only a weak circle of safety and people must invest time and energy to guard against politics and other dangers inside the company, it actually makes us even more selfish and less concerned about one another or the organization. Working in an unhealthy, unbalanced culture is a lot like climbing Mount Everest. We adapt to our surroundings. Even though the conditions are dangerous, climbers know to spend time at base camp to adapt. In time, their bodies will get accustomed to the conditions so that they can persevere. We do the same thing in an unhealthy culture. If the conditions were violent or shocking, with a threat of layoffs every single day, we would never stay. But when the conditions are more subtle, things like office politics, opportunism, occasional rounds of layoffs, and a general lack of trust among colleagues, we adapt. Like being at base camp on Everest, we believe that we're fine and can cope. However, the fact remains that the human animal is not built for these conditions. Even though we may think we're comfortable, the effects of the environment still take their toll. Just because we become accustomed, just because it becomes normal, doesn't mean it's acceptable. On Everest, even after we've adapted, if we spend too long on the mountain, our internal organs start to break down. In an unhealthy culture, it's the same. Even though we can get used to living with stress and low, regular levels of cortisol in our bodies, that doesn't mean we should. A constant flow of cortisol isn't just bad for organizations. It can also do serious damage to our health. Like the other selfish chemicals, cortisol can help us survive, but it isn't supposed to be in our system all the time. It wreaks havoc with our glucose metabolism. It also increases blood pressure and inflammatory responses and impairs cognitive ability. It's harder to concentrate on things outside the organization if we're stressed about what's going on inside. Cortisol increases aggression, suppresses our sex drive, and generally leaves us feeling stressed out. And here's the killer. Literally. Cortisol prepares our bodies to react suddenly, to fight or run as circumstances demand. Because this takes lots of energy, when we feel threatened, our bodies turn off non-essential functions, such as digestion or growth. Once the stress has passed, these systems are turned on again. Unfortunately, the immune system is one of the functions the body deems non-essential, so it shuts down during cortisol bursts. In other words, if we work in environments in which trust is low, relationships are weak or transactional, and stress and anxiety are normal, we become much more vulnerable to illness. Whereas oxytocin boosts our immune system, cortisol compromises it. That our modern world has seen high rates of cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and other preventable illnesses may not be a coincidence. Today, these conditions are far more likely to kill us than threats like violent crime or terrorism. The National Counterterrorism Center estimates that more than 12,500 people were killed worldwide by terrorists in 2011. According to FBI statistics, about 165,000 people were murdered in the United States between 2000 and 2010. More than two-thirds of them with a firearm. FBI statistics do not include Florida. Compare those numbers to the 600,000 people who die every year in the United States from heart disease and the additional nearly 600,000 people who died of cancer in 2012, and the evidence becomes stark. Think about that. 7 times more people die each year from heart disease and cancer than all the people murdered in a decade. Of course, stress alone is not causing all these deaths, but the numbers are so huge and growing, it seems only responsible for the leaders of organizations to take some accountability for how they may be contributing. That something as simple as a corporate incentive system or a corporate culture is actually contributing to these statistics is horrifying. Our jobs are literally killing us. In contrast, a strong organizational culture is good for our health. The environment in which we work and the way we interact with one another really matters. A good working environment helps ensure that we can build the bonds of trust required for effective cooperation. Because our ancient legacy systems can't distinguish between the threats we may have faced in the wilds of the Paleolithic era and the perceived threats we face in a modern work environment, the response is the same. Our bodies release cortisol to help us stay alive. If we work in an environment in which leadership tells the truth, in which layoffs are not the default in hard times, and in which incentive structures do not pit us against each other, the result, thanks to increased levels of oxytocin and serotonin, is trust and cooperation. This is what work-life balance means. It has nothing to do with the hours we work or the stress we suffer. It has to do with where we feel safe. If we feel safe at home, but we don't feel safe at work, then we will suffer what we perceive to be a work-life imbalance. If we have strong relationships at home and at work, if we feel like we belong, if we feel protected in both, then the powerful forces of a magical chemical like oxytocin can diminish the effects of stress and cortisol. With trust, we do things for each other, look out for each other, and sacrifice for each other, all of which adds up to our sense of security inside a circle of safety. We have a feeling of comfort and confidence at work that reduces the overall stress we feel because we do not feel our well-being is threatened. Fire your children. Charlie Kim could sense the tension. Like clockwork, as the end of each fiscal year approached, the feeling around the office would change. It was fear. Fear that if the company didn't make its numbers, some of the people might not make it to the next year. Kim, who founded NextJump nearly 20 years ago, has been through many ups and downs with the company and knows full well the stunting effects that fear or paranoia can wreak on a business. And so he made a bold decision that would dramatically enhance the circle of safety at NextJump. "We want NextJump to be a company that our mothers and fathers would be proud of us building," says Kim. "And a large part of making our parents proud comes in the form of being a good person and doing the right thing." And so he implemented a policy of lifetime employment. NextJump may be the only tech company in the country to do such a thing. No one will get fired to balance the books. And even costly mistakes or poor individual performance are not grounds for dismissal. If anything, the company will spend the time to help figure out what the problem is and help its people overcome it. Like an athlete who goes through a slump, a NextJumper doesn't get fired, they get coached. About the only situation in which an employee would be asked to leave is if they worked outside the company's high moral values or if someone actively worked to undermine their colleagues. It's not as crazy as it sounds. Because it is nearly impossible to get fired once you're in, NextJump takes much more time and is a lot more discerning about who they hire than a lot of other companies in the industry. They don't just consider skills and experience. They spend a lot of time evaluating the character of the candidates who want to work there. For every 100 candidates, only one will get a job. If a leader was told from here on you can't fire anyone, Kim explains, but you must still meet consistent growth in revenue and profits despite market conditions, They would have no choice but to turn to other variables within their control, like hiring, training, and development. Once someone gets in, the leaders of NextJump make it their priority to help the person grow. If they are offering an opportunity for lifetime employment for those who want it, then the leaders of the company have to work hard to bring in the right people. Firing is an easy option, Kim explains. Tough love, coaching, even a program to help people find a job somewhere else if they decide our company is not for them, are all much more effective, but require much more time and attention from the company. To Kim, raising children has many lessons for running a company. Both require a balancing of short-term needs and long-term goals. First and foremost, your commitment is to them for life, Kim says. Ultimately, you want them to become better people. Kim thinks of his employees exactly the same way. He knows most people would never get rid of their children during hard times, so how can we lay off our people under the same conditions, he asks. Despite how much we may fight with our siblings, we can't get rid of family. We have to make it work. Though he may not be the perfect boss or the perfect parent, none of us are, few can dispute how much Kim cares and how hard he works to do the right thing, even if that sometimes means admitting when he gets it wrong. One engineer at the company said that he initially thought the lifetime employment policy was a nice idea for some of the lower performing people, but not much consequence for him, one of the top performers. He wasn't afraid that he would lose his job. What he didn't expect, however, was how much the policy would help him as a group leader. After the policy was implemented, his team started communicating much more openly. Mistakes and problems were pointed out more quickly, long before they escalated. Information sharing and cooperation increased too. Simply because his team no longer feared for their jobs, this group leader saw the performance of his whole team skyrocket. In fact, the performance of the whole company skyrocketed. In the years before the new policy, average revenue growth at NextJump was 25% per year. With no other major changes since lifetime employment was offered, revenue growth has jumped to 60% per year and shows no sign of slowing. Even though many of the engineers at NextJump get job offers from Google or Facebook or other big tech companies, they don't leave. NextJump used to see a 40% turnover among their engineers, a number on par with the industry. With a greater focus on building their people, NextJump now has a turnover rate of just 1%. It turns out, even when offered big titles and bigger salaries, people would rather work at a place in which they feel like they belong. People would rather feel safe among their colleagues, have the opportunity to grow and feel a part of something bigger than themselves than work in a place that simply makes them rich. This is what happens when human beings, even engineers, are put in an environment for which we were designed. We stay. We remain loyal. We help each other and we do our work with pride and passion. When the time is taken to build proper relationships and when leaders choose to put their people before their numbers, when we can actually feel a sense of trust for each other, the oxytocin released in our bodies can reverse many of the negative effects of operating in a high-stress, cortisol-soaked environment. In other words, it's not the nature of the work we do or the number of hours we work that will help reduce stress and achieve our work-life balance. It's increased amounts of oxytocin and serotonin. Serotonin boosts our self-confidence and inspires us to help those who work for us and make proud those for whom we work. Oxytocin relieves stress, increases our interest in our work, and improves our cognitive abilities, making us better able to solve complex problems. It boosts our immune systems, lowers blood pressure, increases our libido, and actually lessens our cravings and addictions. And best of all, it inspires us to work together. This is the reason people who love their jobs, a very oxytocin thing to say, can easily turn down a job that pays more to stay at the job they love. Compared to a culture in which the leaders incentivize reactionary decisions or activities that focus on immediate gratification, a culture in which the selfless chemicals can flow more freely results in greater organizational stability and better long-term performance. And when that happens, our bonds grow stronger, our loyalties grow deeper, and the organization gains longevity. Best of all, we go home happier and live longer and healthier as a result. This kind of culture is possible in any